Welcome to Head Games Radio with our special guest today, Tony Dungy, who will be our 13th, I hope that's a lucky number for you, Tony, our 13th NFL head coach on the show. We really appreciate, in the midst of all of the analysis you're doing probably now on who's going to upgrade your team and, of course, the controversy and the tension around a possible new collective bargaining agreement and the elimination of a potential salary cap as it was. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Nick. I'm only hurt that you invited 12 guys on before you invited me. But it's great to be with you.
Well, if that's the case, then we'll try to do a better job next time. But I do want to get out the official name, Anthony Kevin Dungy, born October 6th, 1955, to Wilbur. And how do you pronounce your mother's name? Cleome?
Cleome, yeah.
Cleome Dungy. You're from Michigan. And you were a quarterback. That's the first thing I wanted to talk to you about was, as you became more and more recognized as an athlete, Tony, you played a number of different sports. But being a quarterback, and of course, back then, a black quarterback was probably pretty unusual. And yet you were MVP of the team at Minnesota a couple times. Tell us what that did for you as a player, how that's helped you in your understanding in becoming one of the best defensive minds in football.
Well, I think growing up as an offensive player, high school and college, and learning the game and playing quarterback, you learned about all different phases of the offense and how to move the football. And being quarterback, you were pretty much thrust in a leadership role. And I think that definitely helped me down the road. Didn't realize it at the time, but being trained a lot, being in that leadership position.
Well, let's talk about the transition, because you were a backup safety during the glory years under Chuck Knoll, and a lot of players today are forced into starting roles at a younger age in the era of free agency. But you were back there. You had to come in. In fact, you're one of the few players ever to have a touchdown and an interception in the same game, I believe, in 1977. What was that like?
Well, it was fun going to that Steeler group. I was not drafted. Ended up changing positions. I knew I was going to change positions in the NFL. So it was kind of nice for me to look to go to a team where I knew I wasn't going to play and start right away. Of course, you always want to play, but Pittsburgh had a great team. They were in the middle of a Super Bowl run, and I was able to go there and learn the game and be part of a championship team while I was learning how to play defense. So it was really the best of all worlds. I played there 2 years and then came back 2 years later on Coach Knoll's coaching staff. And that's really when my real career in the NFL of coaching really started.
What's interesting, though, is how quickly he recognized your talent, and within a couple of years, you were the defensive coordinator. What did you learn from Bud Carson? Bud Carson was on the Chiefs when I was there, and some call him the architect of the Steel Curtain. Certainly, he was one of the great people that influenced that, and he came with such an innovator. What kind of things did you learn from people like Bud Carson?
Well, Bud was my first coach, and I went in with no knowledge of defensive play at all, so everything was new. I was able to learn from one of the best, and he taught me a lot about technique. He taught me a lot about preparing for the game and how to study and how to get ready to play a game and how to be a professional, and I certainly owe a lot to him, to Woody Woodenhofer, George Perlis, the defensive coaches there. But really, Coach Knoll was the guy who put everything together. His method of teaching, the way he did things. You were talking a little bit before, as I was listening to your intro, about how you play the game, the taunting that's coming in, these kind of things, how you develop into a team player. All of those things, that's what Coach Knoll brought. The Steelers had some tremendous players, but it was that team chemistry, team attitude, and the way you learned how to play the game that we all appreciated.
In fact, one of my early memories in the Chiefs was the last game of the 1980 season. We're playing in Pittsburgh.
I remember it well.
And it was really, really cold. And I kicked 3 field goals, and it was snowing. Actually kicked a 50-yarder. And the level of abuse from the fans was pretty impressive, I have to say. But, you know, that was the glory years of the Steelers. The difference to me now, of course, is that this taunting is even more prevalent among the players. I want to play for you, Tony Dungy, a quote from our good friend Tom Jackson, who's been on this show a number of times, about that.
But yes, I think the NFL can do more, and I think the NFL needs to begin with getting that message across to their own. I'll just give you a great example, and neither here nor there in terms of who I root for, but But I've got a game going on this weekend. He has to choose that phone. Just ignore that. where the Pittsburgh Steelers, who I actually admire Bill Cowher an awful lot, but as you watch the beginning of that game, regardless of who you root for as a team, there was something that was uncomfortable about the relentless onslaught of verbal attacks that were going on, regardless of whether it was, you know, the Steelers or I thought more of it was directed from the Steelers, but it doesn't matter. It just matters that you're watching it play out. I know that there are millions of kids who love the game of professional football, who certainly found themselves sitting in front of a TV, waiting on the second game of Sunday afternoon. And it made me uncomfortable. It made me uncomfortable. And like I said, I played very hard-nosed, tough football when I played, but there was just a different attitude. I know that for a fact. There was a different attitude on the field, and that's the one that I wish the league would work at, you know, somehow holding on to. I think, you know, it could benefit kids in a lot of different ways for the athletes to go out and say and, you know, tell kids what they've gone through.
Anyway, that is a part of an interview with Tom Jackson from just a few weeks ago, and I wanted your comment on that, Tony, because you're such a different kind of leader. At the 101 banquet, when you won the AFC Coach of the Year Award just Saturday night, they showed you in the locker room talking about humility and quoting from the Bible about how, and we know about the concept of hubris that the Greek tragedies talked about and the Roman soldiers talked about, that overweening pride is the start of the downfall of all heroes or potential heroes. So is this antithetical? We want to talk about this later in the show with Peter Robey when he joins us too from the Center for the Study of Sport and Society. Do you sometimes feel that you are an unusual animal in the NFL in the way you try to conduct yourself and the way you try to lead your players?
Well, I think I probably am a little bit now. I'm probably what would be referred to as old school, and I probably agree with Tom Jackson that there is a way you do things and a way you go out and play, and how you do it is just as important as what you do. I also recognize that we are in a little different society now. Our young men especially come up in a very verbal society, and being verbal and what you say and how you say it is very important to them. So I do find myself constantly talking about class, about first class, about being humble, about team play, about going out and winning the game, but respecting your opponent, respecting the NFL. And I think a lot of us try to get that across, but it is different. I think we are facing guys who come into the league that the important thing is to express yourself out on the field, to show your individualism, and that's much different than it was 20 years ago.
Well, I'm going to get you off the hook because I'm only going to have a minute and a half before the end of this first segment, but what would you differently, if you do differently, Tony Dungy, if you had Terrell Owens, you took over a team with the Terrell Owens, as happened on the Eagles? How would you handle that situation, a guy with enormous talent but clearly a potential huge distraction to the team?
Well, you're trying to get the most out of everybody. That's your job as a coach, and to have your team be as good as it can be. So you go in, and I've had those situations, and talk to some individual players and said, hey, this is what I need from you. I need you to be a leader. I need you to be on my side if we're going to be a championship team. This is how we're going to do things. This is how we've got to get the other players who are not as talented as you to work within the system and see if you can recruit the guy to your way of thinking. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. And if you don't have a player who thinks the way you think and wants to see the team go in that direction, you do have to make a choice. And most of the time, the best choice is to not have that player around.
You're listening with Tony Dungy, AFC Coach of the Year. Just won the 101 Banquet's AFC Coach of the Year Award and happened to have a couple of decent players alongside him, Peyton Manning and Dwight Freeney. And in our next segment, we'll talk a little bit about the role of the coach in bringing up these individuals, not only as players with enormous talent, but as leaders themselves. We talked about it before with Bill Belichick on the Patriots. All great leaders do it. Tony Dungy's one of them. We'll be right back.